Welcome to Federal Insights for July, sponsored by CyberArk on Federal News Network.
Hello, and welcome to today's program. I'm Eric White. Recently, at the Defense Innovation Unit, there was an Other Transaction Agreement, or OTA, for cyber detection and threat intelligence capabilities. As usual with anything at DIU, we just had to know more. Federal News Network's executive editor Jason Miller had a chance to do just that. He spoke to Patrick Gould, who is deputy director of the cyber portfolio at DIU.
This is actually a really exciting project. So one of the operational cyber teams from the Cyber Mission Force came to us looking for a cyberspace deception technology to go one step further than what we're used to seeing in the commercial world when using deception. So typically, in the commercial world, deception is used for detect and respond. So it's essentially a way to deploy fake artifacts, fake decoys, fake machines, honeypots, honey nets, honey tokens, all these different fake pieces of computing infrastructure throughout an environment as a way to try to see, is anyone interacting with those fake artifacts? And then from there, can a security operations team determine who is that adversary that's interacting with those? What type of malicious activity is being interacted with those? Is it insider threat? Is it external threat? And then from there, can you identify how to best defend against that? What we were looking to do and what the customer on our end was looking to do was to take that one step further and try to figure out, can we not just detect and respond to that threat, but can we start to ratchet up the deception to start toying with an adversary? Can we deploy this around a weapon system for the purposes of protection and intelligence gathering? Can we really play off of the paranoia that most offensive cyber operators have in a way that makes them wonder and question every move they're making as to, are they being watched? Is this a real environment? Is this a real weapon system? Is this a real government network?
All right, pretty interesting stuff. When you put out an OTA, you must do a little bit of market research to see, okay, does this even exist? Or is that the whole point of the OTA is, okay, give us your best, whatever it is, and then we can decide if it exists or not. Sometimes it's a little bit of both, I know.
The majority of DIU projects are demand driven. So we start with a government hard problem. In our case, it's usually a DoD operator hard problem. In the case of some of our more recent ones in the cyber portfolio, they're coming from the cyber mission force or the service cyber components or some sort of cyber performing entity at a COCOM. So they'll come to us with a problem set and they'll kind of work with us to figure out, okay, what is the actual problem? And then we'll do some work with our market research folks and our connections in the ecosystems that we're in. So we have offices in Silicon Valley, we have offices in Boston, we have offices in Austin, but we're not precluded to only work in those areas. We'll go worldwide, but most of our connections are in those areas. So from there, we do the market research to try to figure out, hey, is there a great commercial technology that either already solves that problem or solves 80% of that problem and can be minimally modified to then be applied to that government problem set that came to us.
So it sounds to me like it's rarely you're just throwing some spaghetti against the wall and hopefully it sticks. You know that there's already some spaghetti against the wall sticking and you just write if it's the right spaghetti.
Right. Yeah. And we know that, and what makes us unique is that we know there's a lot of problems that we share with commercial industry. So there's not a lot of unique problems for government when it comes to cyber operations anymore. And so we're going out there and we're looking for, hey, who's already solved this? Who's already done the R&D? What are the world's best products? And how do we become a good customer to the companies that are creating these products rather than trying to redevelop them on our own under formal government program offices or weapon system built?
So you put the OTA out. Can you walk me through some of the results? Did you get a lot of interest? Did you know that there's at least, you know, 3 to 5 to 7 companies available that may be interested or has this type of technology? Walk me through what came from the OTA.
For the specific project, for the deception project, we had about 20 companies that responded. There were about 10 that we knew about before we opened up the solicitation. Since that time period, we've actually expanded our aperture. Typically, what we're used to in the cyber portfolio, about 20 to 30. Recently, over the past few months, we've gotten between 40 and 60. So the word is out there that DIU is soliciting for best of breed commercial products. Our connections are growing, our interactions and our repeat customers are growing as well. So we're getting a lot more interest from the commercial market wanting to do business with the government. And I don't have the data to support whether or not that's because we have more successes that are leading to that and more vendors wanting to work with the DoD, or just because our name is getting out there at this point and we're trying to meet the demand with more vendor demand. So anywhere between 20 to 60 these days, it really depends on how well we've scoped the problem. It really depends on what subset of cybersecurity industry we're looking at. If you're really going after a specific technology set or a specific subcategory of the industry, you're going to get less respondents. But if you're looking at something as wide as detection and response or threat intelligence, you're going to get a lot of vendors coming in and participating.
That's really a great trend to see the numbers going up, 20 to 30, 40 to 60. It means you're right, your marketing, your research, your marketing is doing well, but it also means people are saying when they see that OTA or see that opportunity come out, they're saying that's worthwhile. There's money behind it. There's interest behind it. On this one specifically, you had about 20 companies responded. How many awards did you make? And can you walk me through maybe just some of the technologies that you decided to test out? Because OTAs technically are prototypes.
From those 20 that initially responded, so if you go to our website, diu.mil, and check out our CSO process, the commercial solutions opening, so you'll see that we initially review paper documents. What we ask for up front is a 5 to 10 slide marketing deck or a 5-page white paper. And that's usually something that the vendors already have created. We're not looking for them to do any custom development for the purposes of responding to our solicitation. We want the barrier of entry to be pretty low. So from there, what we do is we review those first, then we'll invite some of them back. So in this specific project for deception, we invited back 6 of the vendors. We at that point, we have in-person pitches and in-person conversations. So it's really an opportunity to have a conversation with the vendor and the problem owner. So we had the military cyber operators in the room with us. And we talk not just about the technology and how it will be deployed and how long will it take to deploy, but what level of skill set is needed to operate it. How is the company doing? Are they profitable? Or do they have other government end customers? Do they have other commercial customers? Are they referenceable? It's supposed to be more of a commercially friendly process that still falls within the line of some of the government competition rules. And so when you look at the OTA and you look at the CSO, what we did is we took out all of the rules of defense finance and acquisition, and we only follow the laws. So because of that, when you look at that process, yeah, you get to the point where you can be a lot more commercially friendly and be a lot more open towards the way that business is actually done in these ecosystems, rather than looking at requirements documents or RFIs or throwing things over the fence and waiting for a vendor to respond. You can have open and honest conversations. So from there, we went with 2 vendors. They both had very specific problem sets. One did more of an enterprise detect and response, similar to what we see in the commercial side, but the one that we saw pretty good results with was on the cyber threat intelligence gathering, as well as the threat hunting side. Talking what I talked about earlier, like looking at the interaction, gathering telemetry from those interactions, gathering intelligence and tools, techniques, and procedures from an adversary that is interacting with these decoys. And it had much more of a military flavor to the operation.
So those 6 came down to 2, and then you guys basically made awards under the OTA to do those 2. What's the now longish term plan? Test them out. How long is this test going to be? How are you testing them out? I know a lot of this can be sensitive. So talk to me, tell me as much as you can, obviously.
Typically, so when we get to the end of that down selection process, we award a contract for a prototype period of performance. So this is a way to not just get the vendor's tools installed into the operator environment and to be able to use them, but we also get to pay the vendor for this time. So it's duly beneficial to both the vendor and the operator for this prototype period. And from there, what we do is we evaluate the process and try to make sure that there is military utility in their commercial product. For this specific project, we're approaching the end of that period of performance right now. So we're at the point now where we're about to declare success that this does have military utility, and we're about to start to go through the process of transitioning to a production other transaction agreement, which is a longer term, larger scale, higher dollar amounts and higher user count instance of this capability beyond a prototyping and evaluation period.
Obviously good news. It's nice when things succeed. Are you doing this for both of the finalists or just one of them?
So right now we're working the process for both of the finalists. They both have very different use cases just because of the way that we went ahead and used that. But we'll see what comes out on the other end of the process.
That's Patrick Gould, Deputy Director of the Cyber Portfolio at the Defense Innovation Unit within the Department of Defense. He spoke to Federal News Network's Jason Miller. We'll have more from this interview after a quick break. I'm Eric White.
As the global leader in privileged access management, a critical layer of IT security, CyberArk protects data, infrastructure, and assets across the enterprise, in the cloud, and throughout the DevOps pipeline. CyberArk delivers the industry's most complete solution, helping federal agencies meet today's challenging security and compliance requirements. And CyberArk is trusted by the world's leading organizations, including more than 50% of the Fortune 500, to protect against external attackers and malicious insiders. Visit CyberArk.com to learn more. That's CyberArk.com.
Welcome back to our interview with Patrick Gould, Deputy Director of the Cyber Portfolio at the Defense Innovation Unit, who spoke with Federal News Network's Jason Miller.
Are you able to tell me a little bit about the technologies that you're using, even at a high level? What did each of the finalists provide? Can you give me any sense without kind of spilling the beans of what you guys are actually doing?
In a nutshell, what it boils down to is the technology is being used to deploy within a cyber operations defended asset list. So if you look at what essentially your crown jewels on the defense networks and the defense weapon system. So the things that CyberComm and the service cyber components most want to defend from malicious cyber activities, we're deploying deceptive elements around them to then essentially create pre-filtered sensors and pre-filtered data gathering capabilities and data gathering devices for the purposes of the defenders of those systems. Now, if they see interactions with these decoys, they can assume that any of that interaction and any of that telemetry and indicator data that's created on those devices is assumed bad, because no one should be interacting with these devices because no one should know that they're there. So from there, so the thought process is you can move these devices and move these fake devices around to different protected enclaves. You can move these around to different weapon systems, or you could leave them in place. So there's a few different ways that we're using them, and it all comes down to the teams that are using them. And each team type that is using this technology is using it in a slightly different way.
That's helpful. I appreciate it. I know there's some sensitivities that are built into this. Yes. So there's only so much you can say. How big of a change is this? How would you rate this on the scale of, 1 to 10? Do you get a sense that this is a big step forward, a small step forward, but important? How would you characterize it?
I'd say it's a big step forward. So there's a lot of detection and response tools that are out there, and the government has a lot of those at their disposal. What we haven't had until this prototype is the ability to deploy these highly tailored and highly targeted decoys and endpoints that fit into these very specific environments for the purposes of information gathering. So we had very good tools to do this across the DoDIN or the information network that the DoD operates on or one of the service networks. But now we have the ability to deploy these fake devices that already pre-filter traffic and indicator data for you in these very specific environments using the indicators and the characteristics of that environment, rather than just doing it generically across an entire swath of the network portion or the entire network itself.
All right, that's good to know, because I think this is a problem that I think it's not just a DoD problem. I think you could argue this is a government-wide problem. This is any organizational problem because of the challenges and because of the concerns about espionage and other things. Is this the type of thing where DIU then could share the results of this OTA, of this project, with other agencies, whether it's the Homeland Security Department or Justice, or pick your agency?
Yes. So specifically within DoD, this is great, because now we're able to create tailored response plans for the types of adversaries that are interacting with these devices. And like to your point, that helps us then share across agencies. And I think you're touching on something that we recently stood up, which is our formal partnership with DHS CISA. I think we can talk about that a little bit later here.
We can talk about it now if you like. I think it's a great partnership, because I think it's an important piece as you all are going down this path. You signed the MOU, I think, late in 2020. What did it say? Give me some background.
The gist of the partnership between us and DHS CISA was, so DoD already had the capability at DIU to be able to get after commercial technology using the OTAs and using our CSO process to leverage those OTAs. DHS CISA was doing a lot of the same things. They were looking at best of breed commercial technologies. And really, we realized that there's a lot of overlaps in the effect, the final effect we're trying to have, which is getting the best technologies in front of the best cyber operators in the name of national security. So there were some folks on our end and some folks on their end that just wanted to break down the administrative barriers that were in the way, whether they were contractual barriers, acquisition barriers, sustainment barriers, or just the fact that we are different agencies and departments. And so we we signed this agreement so that we can get around those and work together. We have our formal DHS CISA embed has arrived at DIU in remotely due to COVID. They were supposed to come in person, but we're all living with the ramifications of remote work at this point. But he's here. He's going to be here for about a year. He's trying to learn the process. We're actually also able to share money. So they're going to send some funds to us to run some DHS specific projects as part of that MOU. And then we're also going to send some of our current projects to transition to them on the back end. So there's a lot of dual benefit here. And again, we're all fighting towards the same goal, which is national security and ramifications in cyberspace. And a lot of us at the practitioner level, the operational level below, don't really care, you know, what rules are in place to hold us back from that. We just want to get after the adversary, and we want to protect the American critical infrastructure.
The person from CISA who's coming to spend time, what will they do? It's more than just watching and learning. How will they participate? And then how are they going to act as, if you will, a conduit back to CISA?
They're actually going to be a formal member of our team. So the role that a product or program manager at DIU would do is that's the role that this individual is going to fill. So they're going to sit at DIU. They're going to work full time at DIU. They're going to share best practices back for the purposes of their day job. But really, while they're here, they're working as a DIU PM to scope problems, to scope solutions, to do the market research, to make those connections with industry, to learn some of the DoD front office mechanics and strategies and policies that best help us get after these problem sets. So yeah, so think of them while they're here as a full-time DIU employee with a connection back to DHS. And then when that year is up, they'll go back to DHS and they're going to help them stand up a dual capability that looks a lot like the way that we do down selections and we interact with industry.
That was actually going to be my next question, whether or not this is the precursor to DHS setting up or CISA setting up something very similar to DIU. I know that DHS has a West Coast, you know, S&T, Science and Technology office, and they've had one for several years, but that's a little different than CISA having one. Do you know, again, I know you can't speak for CISA, but do you get a sense that that's their long-term is to set up something very similar to DIU?
Like you said, I can't speak for CISA. I can't speak for DHS. I do know that I know the terms of this 1 year, which is a lot of data sharing and a lot of work sharing. And now that we have the ability to share funds as well for specific projects, yeah, we're just hoping to build some successes through that year, and we'll see what comes out of that. We're excited either way.
Previously, did you all have some sort of informal relationship with CISA? Was sharing possible, but just harder? And this MOU kind of removes any existing barriers that may have popped up?
A lot of our folks came from the practitioner level of the cyber operations community. So they had informal relationships between other agencies, whether it was the intelligence community or the NSA or Cybercom or DHS or FBI or other law enforcement agencies. So that was there, but this is a real big step, and we're really excited for this one because it does formalize it at more of the operational and strategic level. And like I said, like with that comes a formal person and embed in our organization, as well as some funding to help support some of the projects, as well as now we can formally share the problem areas that we're working on. So we're not doubling efforts potentially and going after some of the same vendors. That's really important to us as well. We want to save money. We want to make the process more streamlined. And if we are interacting with the same vendors, we don't want them to feel that they're, you know, interacting with three different government agencies and maybe none of them are leading to the same goal. But now if we're all leading toward the same goal, which is to get their product in front of the right people to use on operations.
Do you know a little bit about how the background is? Was this something that CISA came to DIU? Did DIU go to CISA? Were you all sitting around one day when we could see each other having coffee and go, hey, we should do that? Do you remember how the MOU came to be?
I actually don't remember the very beginning of it, but I do know that it was just a bunch of like-minded people between the two organizations. And once we got the right decision makers on the Zoom call with each other, magic happened. And before we knew it, we had a person identified, and we had them coming out here, and we had the formal agreement scoped as to, you know, how we're both going to get benefit out of this.
Patrick Gould is Deputy Director of the Cyber Portfolio at the Defense Innovation Unit, speaking there with Federal News Network's Jason Miller. We'll have part 3 of our interview after one more break. I'm Eric White.
As the global leader in privileged access management, a critical layer of IT security, CyberArk protects data, infrastructure, and assets across the enterprise, in the cloud, and throughout the DevOps pipeline. CyberArk delivers the industry's most complete solution, helping federal agencies meet today's challenging security and compliance requirements. And CyberArk is trusted by the world's leading organizations, including more than 50% of the Fortune 500, to protect against external attackers and malicious insiders. Visit CyberArk.com to learn more. That's CyberArk.com.
You're listening to our interview with Patrick Gould, Deputy Director of the Cyber Portfolio for the Defense Innovation Unit. He spoke to Federal News Network's Jason Miller.
I want to shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit about, more broadly, the work that DIO is doing of bringing in civilians from industry into DoD for a year. This is a newer program. We've seen this industry government sharing of people before, but it hasn't worked as well. How is DIU going about it, and how's it going to work? Give me some background.
Yeah, so we have a few formal and informal programs. So first of all, DIU hires civilian employees. So we have a great mix of military, and that's across the active duty, reserve, guard, all the different components, all the different services. And then on the civilian side, we have contractors, we have civilians. Some of them have military backgrounds, some of them have government backgrounds, some of them have none of the above. And DIU is their first experience working with government. So having that mix and bringing in those folks and those different backgrounds really allows us to create diverse teams and diverse thought processes and actually leverage a lot of the connections that come with their experiences and their backgrounds. But more formally, yeah, recently, so we talked about the DHS CISA agreement, but now we also have this, we're leveraging the CITEP program, which is the Cyber and Information Technology Exchange Program. It's a DoD CIO program that allows for industry experts to take a sabbatical and come work for, be formally placed through the DoD CIO into an IT or cybersecurity role. So we took advantage of that program this year, and we actually have our first representative from this program at DIU Mountain View for this fiscal year. And we've had nothing but success from him. So he came from FireEye. He brings a wealth of experience from prior military cyber intelligence work, but also from industry cyber intelligence work at FireEye. And having him on our team up to this point has been nothing but monumental to get that different perspective and really try to educate the folks like me who come from traditional military backgrounds, as well as the other members of the team, and bringing that different perspective helps us be a more well-rounded team and really empathize with vendors as well as the operators, so that we're providing that dual benefit to both entities in the long run.
What's the one thing you would offer that you've learned from him, and what's the one thing you've had to teach him? Because when someone comes to government, the learning curve can be pretty steep sometimes.
Luckily, with this individual, like he came with a, so he's a current reservist in the Army. So he understands a lot of the government process. He's read into all of the government programs when it comes to cyber threat intelligence and cyber operations. He's a super high speed individual, very motivated, very happy to be here. And honestly, like I would say I probably learned more from him than he learns from me. And I know that's a selfish way to look at it, but it's great having him around. It's great to be able to take advantage of this program to get such motivated people into an organization like DIU, but really into the DoD proper in general. I think they would be just as beneficial if it was at DIU or any other cyber IT entity across the DoD.
Patrick Gould is Deputy Director of the Cyber Portfolio for the Defense Innovation Unit within DoD. You can find this interview online. Go to federalnewsnetwork.com and search Federal Insights. I'm Eric White.
Thank you for listening to Federal Insights for July, sponsored by CyberArk on Federal News Network.